It don't matter what I try, I just can't win and I don't know why. There's a fork in every road, I pick the wrong one and then I go. American loser, yes I am. Disenfranchised from everything. Well, I fall up and I fall down. An American loser the day I was born.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of American Loser. It is the podcast that puts the spotlight firmly on second place. We are here, as always, at a shared universe studio in Eatontown, New Jersey. Behind the ones and twos, who else other than the big kahuna? How you feeling, bud?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
There he is.
I'm good. I'm happy to be back here, man. Mike and Ming take great care of us, as always. We're here in the studio. Our guest today is a guy who's going to appreciate all the weird shit up on the walls here at a shared universe studio. I want to say hello real quickly to our guest, my pal, a very, very funny comic guy I used to do open mics with down in the West Orange area. But smart guy, listens to the show, too. And he's a handsome motherfucker. My friend Jay August joins the show. How you doing, pal?
I'm doing all right, KP. We're doing well for making your quota of people that listen to the show, as I am a completionist.
He's smart. He's going to be – it's kind of like when we had Dr. Kate Burke on here, that we're having Dr. Jay August is joining us. He is not a doctorate of anything in particular, but you'll see he's a smart motherfucker as we go. Also, South Beach Larry.
Hey.
How you doing, you delf of a dad?
Yeah, we're doing fine. We're doing fine.
I'm concerned, too. Somebody met you the other day, and they hadn't met you beforehand. And their comment to me afterwards was, you know, that's great, Doug, because I've heard the podcast before. And now that I've met him, I can assert he is a delf.
Thank you, I think.
That's not good. That's not good. Real quick, Jay, what did you go to school for? Because you're a very smart guy.
I went to school for a very short amount of time.
I hear you. You're one of those interesting guys where you kind of learned a lot of on-the-job training, shit like that, right?
Well, my father is a PhD in English. So I grew up with a remarkably diverse and complicated vocabulary that once I became an adult and started doing comedy, I found out these are some weird words that I'm using.
Yeah, did you find that your comedy originally – because you went up on stage the first couple times. We could just tell you were a smart dude. Everybody kind of – did you think that growing up, did that create an obstreperous situation for you to try to overcome?
Ooh, college mouth word.
I think
– proceeds to look up obstretures.
I think my reputation as a Episcopalian is well earned.
Yeah, see, now we're talking.
Wow, these guys got some book learning.
No, he's going to bury me on this one.
Well, this is the episode where Big Kahuna just clocks out and just sits quiet for an hour.
He's been.
But I found out that there was a limitation when I referred to someone as being a curmudgeon, and everyone went, "A what?" Like, I didn't think that was a particularly complicated word.
Yeah, curmudgeon? I've heard of that.
Is that like some sort of a pussy?
I'm just a lowly shop teacher, and I didn't get long well with the written word.
Well, what I always like, because the angle I try to play is that every blue-collar job I've ever worked, people are always like, this guy's smart. What are you doing here? And then you put me around smart people, and they're like, this guy should be like fucking roofing or something. But no, man, we got an interesting guy to talk about here today. So I know that I've been wanting to bring you on for a while, Jay, and I'm happy because I think we got a very interesting guy here to talk about that I know you know a little bit something about. So first and foremost, if you guys don't understand the show here so far, shame on you, first of all right? Then second of all, what we do on the show here is we talk about different losers from American history. Now, a lot of the times, as Kahuna has demonstrated to us, there's different sects of loser, if you will.
Different levels.
All right? So you can have some very weird guys like the guy Charles J. Gatow, who shot President Garfield, all right, which is a very weird thing. And he was a complete psychopath. Then you have other guys that we think of as winners but actually were kind of losers. Then you have other stories where it's like a good guy who just fell on hard times kind of a thing. And today's episode, kind of a little bit of everything here with this guy. He's a pretty interesting fella. Kahuna, when you were a little kid, did you ever watch the movie White Fang?
White what?
White Fang.
No, never heard of it.
You never heard of White Fang?
No.
What about Call of the Wild?
That sounds more familiar, but it's not. I'm not getting an image in my head.
You ever hear the term the great American novel?
Yeah.
Okay, this is pretty much the guy we're going to talk about today is the guy who they essentially crafted all that around. So now my father's here. Jay Augs is here. You guys are going to step in when I'm wrong, all right? Because as someone pointed out in the iTunes reviews, they love the show, but all the research clearly comes from Wikipedia. So.
Not necessarily, but yeah.
A lot of it. So we're going to talk today. We're going to talk about one of the great American novelists, the face of American exceptionalism, he was called. Mr. Jack London. Have you heard of him, Cahoons?
No.
You never heard of Jack London?
No. This one, I'm in the dark as usual. You ready for my jaw to drop today?
it should be dropping. Actually, all of our jaws dropped that you haven't heard of Jack London. That's not good. But we're going to learn you a little something here. Now, he takes a handsome photograph for his time. Don't get me wrong here. Now, Kahuna, you'll notice that in his photo, which we will put up on the Instagram for when we release the episode, this guy existed in the that end of the century, if you will, so the 1800s going into the 1900s, did not live long, all right? If you know anything about writers, you know that they're very happy, well-adjusted people who take good care of themselves.
Which writers are you talking about? That's it.
Now, not for nothing here, I was a writing major for my brief stay at Brookdale Community College. But the guy we're going to be talking about today, like we said, is Jack London, who takes a good photo, but if he was to smile in that photo you were just looking at, Kahuna, you would see a lot of his teeth are missing. All right, another thing pretty common for the time here. We're going to get into why some of his teeth were missing. Fascinating dude here. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, this is Jack London, American Loser. Jack London died. All right, we're going to start at the end here. We're going to do a Tarantino kind of a thing. November 22nd, 1916. He died on a sleeping porch in his cottage on his ranch near Glen Ellen, California. London died from a combination of late-stage alcoholism, including kidney failure, uremia, which, Jay, do you know what that is? Or
it's kidney failure.
Yeah, so yeah. Not good. It sounds...
Yeah, urine is now in your bloodstream. Not a good thing.
Oh, so when you're full of piss and vinegar, that's what they mean. Okay.
Yeah, when you have uremia and kidney failure, it's pretty tough.
All right, and this is, keep in mind, 1916, so it's not exactly, we're not in the Sloan Kettering time frame here. But he also had dysentery, which is just a fun thing to have. It's as fun to have as it is to say. He also has a controversial morphine overdose that's attributed to his death here. Now, London spent the later half of his short life as an American living legend, okay? He had a life filled with adventure and travel. He was accompanied by some of the finest writing in American history, too. This guy was prolific. When you look at his credits, like Kahuna's scrolling through his credits right now on Wikipedia, this dude did some shit, all right? You're having to go full screen on him just to cover all this stuff, too.
It's pages and pages long here, not just written novels, but plays and...
plays, poetry, prolific. Books.
And one of the most significant short story writers...
Yeah,
as well.
And they said that's his best genre, too, mm-hmm. the short story, which I appreciate because we read him in one of my short story classes at Brookdale. And the way that the professor did everything, he would give us the zeitgeist in the background of the author. Then he would give us the zeitgeist of the times he was writing in and then why that was important, what they were talking about. So pretty fascinating dude here in his own right. But the guy was an American living legend. He died one of the most famous people in the world. So he was born now January 12th, to go to the other end of the story here, 1876. London was a descendant of the early Puritans on his mother's side. His mother, her name was Flora Wellman. Now, this is where it gets interesting, all right? Kahuna, you have a creative past. We won't say the good DNA that comes from you, but you come from artists. You know what I mean? That's fair to say?
Yeah.
Right? We won't reveal who it is on the show here. But... you had a was that impacting you the way that you grew up a little bit where you had creative people in the family growing up?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So because you're a pretty creative kid, man.
Well, thank you.
I do think so. It's always a good idea coming out of your head here. You know, it's usually about 10 minutes after I said it, but it's
typically
no. So was that interesting for you because you grew up in a family full of creative people?
Absolutely. I think that because of that, it changed the way I looked at things even when I was younger. I got introduced to different sorts of music early on, different types of movies early on. Like, I think it was, in the long run, a huge benefit to growing up around that. It was awesome.
I would call you a Generation X's millennial, if that makes any sense. There's people that you have an appreciation for things that Gen X people would have. So you're not an average millennial here. You're not just on Snapchat every episode while we're doing this. You got some interesting shit to say.
But, and an appreciation of things that gone on before.
Also true.
Because I love this stuff. That's why I love this podcast so much. I've always loved history and even the losers. So
it doesn't get – now you're going to see – we have to go a little bit crazy here to find the losing in Jack London, but I think you'll appreciate this. You want to talk about a weird upbringing. Flora, Jack London's mother, she spent some time in Ohio before the wealthy family who, like we said, were the descendants of the Puritans. All right, so that's old money. Old
yeah, she's coming
America.
From old
– This is truly –
old-timey money.
This is truly going about a Pulp Fiction way. That was probably spot on. We talked about his death. Now we're talking about his mom. We're going back and forth.
Yeah, well
wait, our gold watch moment's pretty great. So now Flora was interesting. The family moved out west to the Pacific, and Flora there worked as a music teacher and a spiritualist. Jay, do you know what a spiritualist is?
I believe that's when someone believes that they talk to the dead or the mm-hmm. spirit world.
So that's going to have a little impact on you when your mother said – like my memories are of my mom being on the phone with my aunts and yeah, my grandmother
were
or her
dead?
Talking on the phone with a friend. And then imagine now she's having a conversation with dead people and there's no phone in her hand. And you're just like, Mom, are you busy? I'm busy. So,
But at the time, though, that spiritualist kind of a thing was part of the genre of the day. I mean, there was many people at that particular time in history that were fascinated with that whole talking with the past. I mean, Houdini had that whole thing that he was trying to always reach his dead mother. And so, I mean, it's the same time frame.
He hated the fake spiritualist.
Right, absolutely, because he was always – well, we're going off the rails here.
But it's a good off the rails for a second. Yeah. You know, the person who said to told Houdini that they had spoken to his mother – he knew that she was full of shit because he was looking for this his whole life to try to have he was so close with his mom. Mm-hmm. And then this woman claimed to be speaking with Houdini's mother, and Houdini goes, "You're a fucking liar." And then she goes, no, this is what she's saying. She goes, you're saying it in English. My mother never spoke English." So, yeah, beyond the grave, they had a fucking – what do you want to call it?
They had a little pact.
Yeah, a little right. ESL or something like that. You know what I mean? It's to go ahead and teach you English from beyond the grave.
You're not even as far away from the topic as you think you are, because Jack London and Houdini are Eskimo brothers.
Whoa, wait, what?
Yep. They are Eskimo brothers. After London's passing, his second wife was not exactly the marrying type, but she liked to have fun occasionally, and one of her hookups was Harry Houdini.
No shit.
Get out of here.
Now, is it true that I believe when she was having sex with Houdini that during sex he actually got up, left, and then walked around outside and waved to her from the window? That's how they got called a Houdini, all right?
Oh, wow.
Jesus. Fascinating fact here. We're going to get into that in a second. London's life is – it's wild, man. This guy's a rock star. If you want to draw a comparison to who somebody might think he might be, if you want to draw a little bit of a comparison to maybe a Chris Cornell or a Kurt Cobain kind of a person, there's a lot of it in there because there's some weird shit going on with his life as we're going to get to. Now, spiritualism, like you were saying, LP, pretty popular in the day. Not a wacky thing. She's not the only one who thinks she can talk to these dead
spirits. Well, it was scoffed at, but it wasn't out of the norm for people to have those kind of leanings either. So, I mean, everybody was forever was always trying to talk to the dead. I mean, who wouldn't want to talk to dead
Well, she had an interesting person,
rather than
Flora.
Seeing dead people on your television or something.
Right. Flora had an interesting person that she could was in regular contact with too. She claimed to be in contact with Black Hawk, who is a chief of the Sauk tribe, who had fought against the Americans in the War of 1812, hoping to stop the spread of the white man, if you will, which is kind of hilarious because Black Hawk, we've honored him by naming our helicopters and a Chicago hockey team after him. So didn't quite stop the spread of the white man into the Midwest and everything. But at least
we got some kick-ass helicopters.
Yeah, you got a couple Stanley Cups out of it.
Certainly a warrior, though. I mean, and I think that's the whole vibe with the Black Hawk helicopter and, of course, the warrior aspect of the hockey team. So.
Oh, absolutely. And you'd hope, too, because not for nothing, it'd be very funny if Flora was in there. She goes, no one come in here right now. I'm a Black Hawk. I got some Black Hawk coming over.
Yeah. Incoming.
Oh, boy. Now, Flora knew many people and many spirits, but she didn't seem to know the father of her son, Jack, or at least she never admitted it publicly. So for a woman, she knows all these spirits and everything like that. Can't quite figure out who her father is.
No, well, who her
– I'm sorry, who her baby daddy is.
Right.
I apologize. Well, good catch. London's biographer surmised that Jack's father is astrologist. Now, we say astrologist here, Jay. When you hear astrologist, you probably know the true meaning of it. I heard astrologist and I was like, oh, cool. He's a scientist with a telescope. What do they mean by astrologist in this time frame?
Basically, you're another fortune teller, a horoscope. Your horoscopes and what the moon and your phases.
So mom talks to the dead spirits and dad can tell you when your chakra is going to be aligned with the stars.
And your lucky numbers are.
Yeah, and doing horoscopes and shit. So that's going to lead to an interesting child. No? Is that fair to say?
Not in this instance. I mean, if you want to talk genetics, sure, but they're not super involved as he grows up necessarily.
No, not at all. And then there's even a very weird letter that comes in later on in the story too as well. London's biographer surmised that Jack's father was this astrologist. That's that ancient biblical stars are telling us the past and future type. The guy's name was William Cheney. Mom talks to dead people. Dad gets messages from the stars. Sounds like a very happy, creative family for a child to grow up in. They'd never really find out though because Flora was living with Cheney at the time that she became pregnant. But there are no records of whether or not they were married. But Flora did go by the Cheney last name several times.
Right.
So a lot of the records got destroyed.
There's a lot of reports, too, that mom wasn't exactly monogamous in her relationship with Cheney. So
it's funny, too, because there is that we have this idea that the California thing, the whole hippie free love move, we have an idea that that started in the 60s with the sexual revolution. This shit was going on beforehand. All right. People a little loose out west, man. It just is what it is.
There was just no Woodstock yet.
Yeah, you're right. Well, Kinison had a great bit too, because Kinison was, you know, Sam Kinison, one of the greatest stand-up comics of all time, who started off in Texas. He talked about when he got out to California, and he goes, yeah, and I was dating a girl out there who goes, I love you enough that if you really want it, I'll bring another woman into our bed. And he goes, you got to move to California because that's the only place they make those kind of women. And that was back in the 80s. But a lot of the records were destroyed in the 1906 earthquake, so you really can't figure out. There's not too much to trace on the actual story here. However, there are some articles in the newspaper written about a pretty noteworthy event. Cheney demanded Flora get an abortion. All right, he wants her to abort what will become Jack London, one of the greatest authors of all time. Demands Flora get an abortion, and in her refusal, she actually protests by shooting herself. Kahuna. Yeah.
Not shot dead though.
Well, I would, yeah.
Just kind of making hey, look at me kind of a statement.
Your puzzled look is correct, friend.
like in the foot? Or is it not specified? I'm so confused. Why did she shoot herself?
Well, it's not a great way to demonstrate you're unhappy with the situation. But what were you going to say, John?
Well, she had two suicide attempts in this.
Yes.
One was an overdose of laudanum, which didn't take. So then she tried to shoot herself in the head. And I believe the gun misfired. So, you know, she might be the early one for losing it, dying.
Well, I just picture young Jack London asking, Mom, where do babies come from? Well, sometimes when a mommy and a daddy disagree on whether or not they should become mommies and daddies, mommy will take a lethal dose of laudanum to the head. But sometimes you just stick around because you're a stubborn little bastard, aren't you, Jack? No, interesting here. So she does shoot herself, and though she's not seriously hurt, she is considered temporarily insane. After giving birth to young baby John, who would later become known as Jack, the baby is given to Miss Virginia Prentice, LP. Yeah. What's interesting about Virginia Prentice?
There's a lot of things that are interesting about Jenny Prentice or Virginia Prentice. She was a former slave who actually became John or Jack's wet nurse, that she had just recently delivered a stillborn, and then Jack was put in, or John was put into her care for the upbringing. But she was an interesting person to begin with. She's a former slave from Virginia, but she was made like the companion of the plantation owner's daughter. So she early on learned how to read and write. So she was an educated woman. And then when the Union kind of took over the plantation during the Civil War, or, you know, entered onto the property, she took off for safer locales, I think ended up in Missouri, and then eventually made her way to San Francisco, where Jenny Prentice marries Alonzo. Now, Alonzo
That's Alonzo Mourning from the NBA, correct?
No, not quite. I think it was Alonzo Prentice, but anyhow, she Jenny and Alonzo go from Missouri and then comes into San Francisco in the 1870s. Alonzo was a carpenter, and you know, as the Jack was put into her care, she really became his mammy, his second mother.
And, well, it's important too because people will try to say that Jack London was racist. That comes up later on, and it's not necessarily against African Americans, but clearly a very affectionate relationship between him and Miss Prentice.
Yeah, they say that all the nurturing that Jack did receive as a child was really due to Jenny's doing, nothing really from the mother. There was really no strong maternal instinct between Jack and his natural mother, but it was more from Jenny. She. The families remained close all through his upbringing, and John or Johnny came to view the Prentice children, who you know she later had additional kids. Unfortunately, Jenny's kids never really lived beyond early childhood.
So. Brutal times, man. Yeah, brutal times for that tough. Shit.
But. You know, Johnny comes to view the Prentice children as his cousins and attends various African-American activities as a church and family. Jack London really got his first introduction to any kind of religion through the nurturing of Jenny.
Oh, so because of Virginia? Or because of Jenny, he starts to become a little
well,
bit
more. Well, Virginia is Jenny.
Jenny is a nickname for Virginia.
Oh, okay. So then.
God. Yeah.
So wait, his mom was a spiritualist then, but she wasn't really heavily religious. Is that why?
Right. Yeah. So, okay. So Virginia, his African American stepmother, if you will, you know, who's playing the role of mom, if you will.
Yeah.
She is pretty much the reason that Jack has anything good in his life early on because, like we said, dad wants nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
Wanted you to be aborted. Mom put a hole in her head. To try to get rid of you, and then she's busy talking to dead bodies and stuff like that. You know, oh, the spirits in this place, they must be great. And Jack's like, can you please fucking feed me?
right. Can I have something to eat? Yeah, but he's introduced to religion, you know, formal religion, through the nurturing of Jenny, attends Sunday school at the First African Methodist Episcopal Church, or the AME Church. Jack really showed his love for Jenny later on after he became, you know, a wealthy man by donating a substantial sum of money to her church. And even after his death in Jack's will, he provided for his stepmother, his mammy that supported that, who was by that time a widow, but remembered her in his will. That the quote that I came across was, "To my old mammy, Jenny Prentice, my estate shall pay $15 each month. Also, in addition, my estate shall see that she is suitably housed and shall pay for said housing."
Also, a lot of money back then. He wasn't just being a cheap fuck.
Yeah, $15 each month. That's big bucks.
Yeah.
That's big bucks. I mean,
back then.
And then
makes you wonder, too, because why bother? This is the other thing, too. They actually tried to – they named a street after Jack London in Canada. And then the liberals up in Canada went nuts about it because there was allegations that Jack London was racist. So they actually changed the name of the street back to something stupid like 2 Mile Street or something like that. So they went back to like a super generic name because that's why I feel like it doesn't matter when you try to do try to be as progressive as you can here, but in 30 years, we're all going to be called racist. That's just what it is because progress moves on and then you undo. So Jack London gets this bad reputation as a racist guy, even though he donated a big ton, like a huge portion at the time of his fortune to a black church that he grew up in and had this great family with and shit. So yeah. Just wild stuff.
Because he did have some racist things going on, just didn't had nothing to do with black people.
Right.
You know, when supposedly he had coined the phrase the Great White Hope.
That was about, yeah, that's that. We were going to try to avoid that with the whole Jack Johnson thing, but Jack Johnson being an amazing black boxer, my buddy Chris DiStefano, his podcast, History Hyenas, did a whole episode on it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to stay a little bit far away from that one if we can, but he did coin the term, right, the Great White Hope, for that fight.
Right, but it wasn't in a racist sense. He was saying that no matter whatever the race the person was, you have to admire that Jack Johnson was an amazing fighter.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, he was also having a few short stories that were talking about, like, I think one of them even might have been called The Yellow Peril.
Because he coined the Yellow Peril about the influx of Asian immigrants coming in.
Particularly the Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, because if you keep in mind, too, out in San Francisco, that was – you had Ellis Island in New York, and then you had Angel Island out west. So that was where all the Asians were coming in from there.
Yeah.
But pretty cool stuff here. We're going to move on forward with this one if we can. We got to – I want to keep these at about an hour, all right? And we're already 24 minutes in because LP wants to – LP's doing the mammy history.
Sorry. He did 15 minutes on his mom. You're going to blame LP.
Busting chops, man. No, it's important that we lay that groundwork here, too, for him, because I want to try to give an accurate portrayal of the guy here. But his life is so fucking interesting. And it's a short life, too, by the way. You have a shorter lifespan back in the day, but this guy had an extra short life. And we're going to realize it's because he liked to drink a little too much.
Well, number of issues, but yeah.
Yeah, also, yeah, I think the list of his final, we'll get to it at the very end here, but the things that finally killed him, I think it's like about a list about a page long of shit that was wrong with him at the time.
Jesus.
But in 1876, Flora married a disabled Civil War veteran named John London, and the young boy was taken in and they moved out to Oakland. Oakland at the time, going through some crazy stuff, John Gruden's decision to trade Khalil Mack to the Bears. Still not well received.
Wow, Kevin.
All right, so he was dealing with a lot of stuff with that. London would complete grade school in the San Francisco and Oakland area. It becomes a huge, huge chunk of his life because he's actually all of his stories, for the most part, a lot of them take place in the San Francisco area. So what's really cool here too is that his sense of adventure and bold new ideas of the times had a deep impact on London, who would often study for school in a famous saloon. So you're a boy studying for school in a bar known as Heinold's First and Last Chance Saloon. LP, why did they call it the First and Last Chance Saloon?
It was a very – it still stands today, but it was right on the waterfront, and it was your last chance to grab a drink before you're on a long sea voyage, or your first chance to grab a drink as you're coming off a long sea voyage.
I'm not drinking right now. Maybe I'll never drink again. Who knows? But if I do ever make it out there, I'm having one for Jack London at the First and Last Chance.
There you go. Was interesting too that he's
where is it in California?
It's in Oakland.
I might be going right out there in the next 3 weeks. I'll take a picture and send it to you.
Put that on the list, guy. Put that on the list. What was interesting too, now here's he's a schoolboy and he's in this it's a saloon of nothing but waterfront toughs, if you will. So he's overhearing a lot of the stories that the various seafaring men are talking about. He is learning to become learning the sailing craft or how to navigate. But there was also references to the fact that there was this really large addiction. It's kind of a gong show going on.
Oh my God, you're subtle.
You tried to discreetly take the cup holder out.
You need to recap that now.
It was as subtle as a hand grenade.
Yeah, just let you guys know, in my boredom of my father's speech.
Wow. All right.
No, I'm fucking around here. Mike and Ming,
don't
come on.
Leave us.
Yeah, Mike and Ming, how about a real podcast table in this second studio instead of a fucking poker table, you cheap fucks? All right?
Damn, man.
I've paid enough money in this place. We should have a real table in here, Kahuna. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
But no, I'm messing around on that one. I just tried taking I clanged my glass bottle against one of the metal pieces in the table here, and it made a loud noise, and it pissed me off. So I threw it on the ground where it made a louder noise. So it's through the other one, which in turn also made a sound. Luckily now, I am out of things to throw.
All right.
So, I think
so far, we still have phones and a couple other things scattered about.
London spent much of his time over at Heinold's here. It's being used as the early setting for a lot of his works. John Heinold, the owner of the establishment, even winds up lending London money for him to attend the University of California, Berkeley. That was his dream to go out there. Right?
That's cool.
Now, long before his short stay over at Berkeley, London had already lived a rather peculiar life. London was an avid reader and was largely self-educated with encouragement from his quote, and we're going to use this term loosely, Kahuna, creative mother. Okay. She's busy talking to the dead spirits up in the attic somewhere. Yeah. Then she comes down and she goes, "Oh, John, you should write. You have such a vivid imagination, John." London was also guided by, this is kind of cool here, a woman at the library. He used to go down to the library in San Francisco, and there was this sympathetic woman here who worked at the library. Her name was Idna Coolberth, who helped London in his self-education. She would encourage him to read, all that other stuff. Now, she herself goes on to become one of the most important poets in the San Francisco Bay Area writer scene, which is a happening fucking scene. This is all – you want to talk about the 60s and the, you know, the Woodstock, all that other shit? The original, like the whole San Francisco, the Haight-Ashbury shit or whatever it was called.
So it just kind of – so just history repeated itself in an odd way kind of then.
Yeah. Well, it was a happening place. You have to have the seeds in order to grow into any sort of thing kind of cool out there. So this stuff's going on way before the whole hippie revolution, if you will. But anyway, Idna Coolberth goes on to become one of the best writers, the best well-known writers, too, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And this is a girl who just happens to be working in the library and encouraging a guy who's going to go on to become the most famous author in America.
Yeah, she becomes the poet laureate for the state of California. She's
See, I never know how to say laureate. I never know how to pronounce that word, so I just avoid it at all costs.
It's laureate. Ask Jay, he'll tell you.
He would know it. What's the correct pronunciation of that, Jay?
LP had it perfectly. It's poet laureate.
Nice. Now we're talking. I only know that term because of Mikowski. That's in 1889, London began working 10 to 12-hour days at age 13. Okay. Kahuna, you're 21, right?
Yeah.
And you still watch cartoons.
Yes.
So, I am 31 and still try to tell jokes for a living. So both of us are complete failures on the Jack London scale. He was working 10 to 12-hour days in a cannery at age 13. Now, seeking a way out, London borrowed money from, guess who, LP?
I know who.
Who?
His mammy, Virginia Prentice. Prentice. Yeah, Virginia Prentice. She gave him money to buy his first boat.
And the boats, by the way, one of the great names here. Jay, if you were to have a boat, what would you name it?
If forced, I would call it the Razzle Dazzle.
On point, my friend. He buys a sloop sailboat known as the Razzle Dazzle, Kahuna, and he becomes Jack London, who will become one of the great authors in American history. Starts his life out as auspiciously as possible as an oyster pirate.
He's pirating oysters.
Wait, what?
Kahuna thinks we're fucking around here.
Yeah. Honest engine.
Because like I'm like trying to follow along because I truly did feel bad that I didn't know who this guy is. Although further inspection, I did know what Call of the Wild was, but I was reading and then you were just like oyster pirate. I was like, where the fuck does it say that?
This is illegal oyster pirating off the coast of California.
Oh, illegal oyster pirate. Okay, he's an actual oyster pirate.
Right. Is, they don't use the term. It's not like because we talked about this before. You hear pirate, you assume movie recorded with, you know, a cell phone camera. But no, it's interesting here because he winds up working as an oyster pirate. These are the men that would they would illegally harvest oysters.
Or steal somebody else's.
Right, and become a large part of some of London's early literary works. But within a few months, the Razzle Dazzle was damaged beyond repair. And London, who enjoyed his life on the water, decided to join up with the California Fish Patrol. Kind of a weird move.
The other end of the spectrum.
To join the California Wildlife Commission after working as a – any job experience? Well, I've worked in a similar field before.
Yeah, I tried to hide from you guys, so I know all the tricks.
I mean, it's the best job after being a person like that because then they're like, now we need you. How'd you get away from us to teach all the tricks?
There's a catch me if you can kind of a vibe here.
Yeah. Right?
Now, London's time at sea would take him on a voyage to Japan. Upon returning to the United States, he found his home of California in rough shape due to the Panic of 1893. Kahuna, can you remember the first topic we talked about on this show for American Loser?
No.
President Grover Cleveland, all right, who was president in his second term. He's the first president to ever serve non-consecutive terms. And in the Panic of 1893, which was largely blamed on Grover Cleveland and his, quote, bourbon Democrats.
Yeah, and unfortunately, all of that took place because of legislation that was passed before Grover Cleveland came into office. But he still took the he still took the blame for it. But.
Right. So now he also had that break in service too, where it was Benjamin Harrison that was really fucking everything up. But he was already out of office by the time the hit happened. So the unrest during this time leads to London's quote radicalization for workers' movement and his left-leaning politics. He joined a movement known as Coxey's Army, led by Ohio businessman Jacob Coxey, and began his life as a, quote, tramp, So this is where Jack London's bouncing around all over the place, pretty much doing the vagabond bohemian thing. But LP, what is Jay, do you know what Coxey's army was?
You got me on this one.
It's not a, it's a weird thing here, but LP knows a little bit more than I do.
Coxey's army was just this whole – it was really the first march on Washington to demand workers' rights and jobs. That people were a huge unemployment throughout the nation, and people were just demanding jobs. And this guy, Coxey, starts this whole movement that they were going to march on Washington. And there was a lot of other similar movements as well that I don't believe Jack London actually marched with Coxey's army, but there was another guy, Keeley, that became known as Keeley's army that was started in a different section of the country. But they were just going across the country and trying to get to Washington any way they could by hijacking trains, and then they would be fed by the locals as they moved across the country, that by the generosity of farmers and the locals that would come out and feed these guys. And we're talking a substantial number of people. So, then a lot of it, the whole socialist upbringings, if you will, or starts were kind of developed through this whole thing that, you know, you're out of work and who are you going to blame? Well, the banks and big business and the railroads that
– Right. I get not trusting the government too, because you're all the way out in California at the time. So your representation is actually further away in a lot of estimations than when England was going over the colonies. So you're like, oh, cool. That's great. You know, we got our own thing now, but you're all the way over there. There's that saying in Japan that what was it? I forget, life is good when the emperor is far away, kind of a thing. There's no way that there's no tyranny rather when the emperor can't really see what's going on. But at the same time, there's also not a whole lot of laws. So California is essentially about as wild west as it gets at this time. They got a little bit of thing. There's certain cultures built up and shit like that. But
yeah, but Jack London also had some a lot of today we would call it blue collar work. You know, he worked in this cannery for 12 to 18 hours a day as a 13-year-old, being paid like nothing. Slave labor type of a thing. He works as the oyster pirate. He's working for the California Fish Patrol. He's on this sailing schooner going off the coast of Japan. He works in a jute mill, which is another, you know, very mundane, breaking you all kinds of hours a day. He works in a streetcar power plant in San Francisco. And, you know, everybody's out of work. So that the whole terminology of the hobo's life, the riding the rails and just trying to find an existence somewhere, you know, a handout or a short-term employment, this is really what this whole movement was all about. They were really just an army of like 10,000 of hobos that would just invade a town and
but a hobo's life is better than a life in a cannery at this point. So yeah, you're not eating as much and you're sleeping in weird fucked up places, but you're not in the cannery. So that's what, you know, it winds up being better off that way, for in my estimation at least. Now
it's probably because you lost your job in the cannery though,
and you hate it when you smell like fish.
Also true. Right. Now what's interesting here too is that he gets arrested for vagrancy and winds up spending 30 days in Erie County Penitentiary in Buffalo. Grover Cleveland, not at the same time, but Grover Cleveland, the president responsible for the Panic of 1893, was also the sheriff of Erie County before he was president. So London's interred up at this penitentiary, if you will, and he said that it was some of the nastiest conditions he'd ever seen in his life. Really had a profound effect on him. Now, London's time as a sailor and a hobo made his stories highly entertaining. So now all of a sudden he's the happy hour hero down at Heinold's First and Last Chance Saloon, because he's got some good stories of his own to kind of, you know, hold his water, if you will, with the fucking locals. So he entered and won a writing contest at the encouragement of his mother, who told him, like, oh, you have to write this great story. It's such a good story. Write it down on paper. Put it in for this contest. And he winds up beating several college-educated writers. Now, this is just a kid working in a cannery. So he's already got a natural predisposition for this. It also reinforced London's desire when he won the competition for higher education. We already talked about how he's talking to the bar owner. Normally when you talk to a bar owner or a bartender about something, it's how to get your wife to quit busting your balls. Jack London's talking to the bar owner about dreaming of going to the University of California, Berkeley. So after passing his examinations and being accepted into Berkeley with money from Heinold's, funding the education effort, London is actually unfortunately forced to leave school due to insufficient funds. All right, so he finally accomplishes his dream and then just can't make it work. So around age 21, London searches for and finds the newspaper article, and I imagine that it would also be at the library, so Edna Coolberth is probably involved in this part of the story too.
All your research, you weren't Googling that stuff back then, so your best place for doing any kind of research is at the library. So it would make sense that we can assume that that's where the discovery was made.
Well, he goes ahead and he finds the article about his mother's attempted suicide while pregnant. And that's kind of a tough thing to read about.
While she was pregnant with him.
Yeah. Kind of a tough thing. Hey, Mama, what was pregnancy like? What were you eating? Were you, what methods of yoga were you going to?
Oh, you could find that in the Sunday Times.
There was also a story that made it into the paper about the father's abuse of the mother when she was pregnant. Now, did he find that as well?
They don't say if he found that part here, but he did find out about his father a little bit. So he goes ahead. Now, if you don't know, if you're a new listener to the show or you just haven't figured out the dynamic yet, I'm actually adopted. I love the shit out of my dad here. I'm not biologically your son, but it was prearranged. I was your kid before I was even born, right? So everybody knows that. But if you don't know, now you do know. That is why when you meet my father, he is a tall, handsome, strapping man with very low body fat. And I, on the other hand, am Barney Rubble. But he goes ahead and he writes a letter. When he's reading about this article, he decides to write a letter and reach out to the man he believes might be his father, Mr. William Cheney. Cheney now not only denies being his father, he says, there's no way I'm your father because, first of all, I'm impotent and your mother's a whore. So, not exactly how you wanted to find this one out here.
Yeah.
So he's saying, he goes, my shit don't work, so I can't be your dad. So not only is this letter to your dad wrong from the onset, also your mother was she had loose morals, if you will. And then on top of that,
it's also kind of reflective as to why he asked her to abort back when it's not his kid. She's living with him. It's not his kid. And everybody's going to assume that he's the daddy. And he's not – he knows for sure he's not the daddy. So, I mean – that was kind of a devastating thing to Jack.
Now, on top of that, so you're already you're striking out hard here, all right? So you're finding out your mom is not the essence of purity that she might be considered.
Right.
You're finding out the guy you think is your biological father says he physically can't be, all right? You're also reading the article about how, as Jay was saying, there was abuse going on in the household. Your mother tried to kill herself rather than give birth to you. And then on top of that, he also says the last line here that kind of broke Jack London's spirit. He goes, William Cheney tells me, he goes, actually, Jack, if you're really looking for a victim in all this, it's me, not you. I've got it way harder than you. I got all these allegations coming at me. People think I'm a bad dude. So really, I feel bad for you. But, I mean, just be grateful you're not me, Jack.
Yeah, right.
So, oh, boy. That one had a little bit of an effect on him. You ever, after a breakup, sometimes you need a change of scenery. So now something devastating happens here to our boy Jack London, finds out all this shit, decides his next adventure is going to be to move out to the Yukon, which is experiencing something known as the Yukon Gold Rush. Lawrence Patrick Burke, while I piss this nitro coffee out of my bladder, please tell us what the Yukon Gold Rush is.
Well, the Yukon Gold Rush was really kind of timely because, again, we had the whole economy of the United States in a turmoil. Everybody's out of work, and then all of a sudden we're discovering gold in the Klondike. Now, the Klondike is not Alaska. The Klondike is the western end of Canada. But for most people to get to that, you got to go through Alaska, which is the United States. So there was a couple of different routes to get there, but
the most common
was to go leave either Seattle or San Francisco. It really started to put Seattle on the map because the newspapers got hold of this, got wind of this for this gold strike in the wilds.
Did it last long?
No, it was only a couple of years long, and then things just kind of petered out, and then gold was discovered in Alaska, and the whole shift kind of went away from the Yukon over to Alaska. But different towns like immediately sprung up overnight, towns that were like maybe 50 or 100 people. Now all of a sudden you got 20,000 people invading this thing. And
do you think that there was people – the reason that there was almost like a quote-unquote invasion was because there are people still holding out from the California gold rush that were just like, oh, maybe there's a chance up here. And then it's like,
well, no, I mean, fortunes certainly were made during the California gold rush, but yeah. where, you know, 50 years.
It's gone by, I know, but right. I'm still like, I'm talking about those people who are like, maybe there's hope yet. Like, I don't know. I was just curious.
Yeah, well, if you're out of work or the whole economy is in the shitter and now there's an opportunity for making a fortune, there's a lot of people that are going to risk that. And it was a very difficult decision, if you will, to get there.
Like going to outer space.
And who can get there first. Yeah.
That's what I would argue it would be.
You know, when I was reading this doing the research on this too, I was thinking about when the whole Alaska pipeline was put in. A lot of guys were out of work. A lot of people were saying, "Well, go up to Alaska and work on the pipeline for construction up there." You know, they're paying you exorbitant sums of money. Yeah, you're going to have to make some major sacrifices, and these people made some major sacrifices. And the amount of people that actually did strike it rich. Very, very, very small percentage. A lot of people died.
So it's just like comedy, is what you're saying.
It's just like comedy.
Very, very few of us make any money off of this.
Some of the trails
also
in
just
there,
Hollywood in general.
some of them were called the one pass or route was called Dead Horse because it was literally littered with dead horses and pack mules and everything else because the Canadian government put restrictions on who was allowed into the thing. And you had to have like 1,000 or 1,200 pounds worth of equipment. That the winners are you know, totally inhospitable that they were requiring that you come in there with 1,200 pounds worth of gear. And now you had to go up these mountain passes and stuff, and people would have to pack that in and out. Now, you can't – one guy cannot carry 1,200 pounds worth of shit. So that means you now have to break it down into like 65 or 80-pound parcels, and you're up and back, up and back, up and back, you know, how many times before you can actually get your stuff to the other side of the mountain and continue.
Because when things are serious that way too, because one of my finest memories with my father, Jay, is that he and I went on a high adventure canoeing trip. In the what was it? The Upper Saranacs, right?
Yeah.
So in
the Adirondacks,
it was a 50-mile canoe trick, and what you had to do that was pretty cool was that the guide, the first day that you were in base camp, would go through your backpack. And I always thought this was kind of similar because in some of the movies I've seen about the Yukon Gold Rush and the books and everything, they always talk about the town getting provisions before you go in. So before this trip, it was called what was the name of the camp?
Floodwood.
Floodwood Scout Reservation. So before you go out on this 50-mile canoe trek, the guide goes through all your bags and everything like that. And I just remember how funny it was because we, in order to save space, I put a bunch of salt into a plastic bag rather than a salt shaker because I thought you could slide it into the front pocket of a backpack that way. And the look on the guide's face when he's going through my bags to make sure I have everything, and all of a sudden there's just a bag of white powder. And he's sitting and goes, "All right, I guess that's, you know, we don't need coffee now. That's good." So, but now London's up there in this Yukon territory like we talked about. Now there's a sense of adventure to this. This is what Jack London is kind of synonymous with as far as my estimation, you know. Spends less than 2 years, though, of his entire life is actually spent up in the Yukon territory. But his experiences there wind up changing his life forever. Like, I didn't spend a shitload of time on a ship in the Navy. I was there about 2 years on the USS Kearney. But that has a huge impact on you. It affects the way you look at your life.
A lot of the
Based
stuff
on how often you bring it up, yeah.
Well, I had 4 years after that, too.
A lot of the things that he writes about later on is from real-life experiences that he had in the Yukon, too. And he didn't really make any money for gold, but he was making money for working for other people who were looking for the gold kind of a thing.
You have to imagine that White Fang and Call of the Wild never happened
right.
without this time in the Yukon.
Right, absolutely.
Without a doubt, for sure.
And this is going back to where we led in with Handsome Jack with his photograph with his mouth closed. He's not smiling for the photograph because life is so hard up there, and you know, provisions are running low. People are starving to death. People are freezing to death. And scurvy is a major concern because you're not getting a whole lot of citrus fruit up in Alaska or up in the Yukon at this time. And he actually loses the four front teeth due to scurvy. And scurvy is a lack of vitamin C. I mean, going into the British Navy kind of a thing, that's where they got the terminology as limeys, because they determined that scurvy comes from the lack of vitamin C. So eventually they started packing in limes and lemons for the long sea voyages, but they didn't have that up in the Yukon. So,
which is interesting, because the people up there who the native people there, their diets are almost exclusively fat and meat, and it's weird because just the American standard diet or whatever. We tried to have that while these guys were living up there, and they're dying of scurvy, and their teeth are falling out, and they look like hell. But the native people up there who are eating just fat and meat, their teeth are still preserved in perfect condition when they find the fossils. It's pretty remarkable. But he does develop scurvy, like you said, other gum diseases, winds up losing four of his front teeth. While he's in the Yukon Territory, he winds up being taken care of by this legendary figure up there known as the Saint of Dawson, Father William Judge. Okay? So this guy, he's been in a bunch of movies and stuff like that too. Very, very fascinating guy. But he pretty much had the almost a soup kitchen hospital of sorts for the people who were coming in who were in poor condition. London's time there, like you were saying though, Jay, while he's being taken care of by the Saint of Dawson, is where he writes To Build a Fire, which is still heavily studied by English and literature professors around the world and is considered by his own critics to probably be London's best work. That's my favorite of the short stories. And there is not a lot of happy endings either, because we Kahuna brought it up earlier. You can see White Fang. There's the Disney spin on this one.
Right.
Where it's, you know, hanging out with White Fang, and, you know, White Fang's a talking dog voiced by Eddie Murphy or something. But no, these are sad, desperate kind of books, if you will. Majority of the stories are just about the brutality that's being experienced out there. And there's also a nature of hubris, too, where the guy in The Call of the Wild decides he's not going to listen to the advice of the people in the camp, that he's out there to make his own. And winds up dying out in the frigid woods. And he, in the building of the fire, too, kind of a nice twist of irony here, he builds a fire, and then the heat from the fire melts the snow on a branch above the fire and causes all the snow to fall down on the fire. So it's like
– He douses it. Yeah, it's actually two different versions of To Build a Fire.
Yes, sir.
And I think they were published 2 or 3 years apart. One has a – more black ending, we'll call it, you know.
Some heavy shit.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, very, very interesting guy. And again, a lot of these experiences and stories that he's heard of or talked about were later in his writings. That he's writing about what he lived. It's pretty cool.
I would argue that, you know, and some of you, Call of the Wild and White Fang, both have happy endings, because I like dogs more than people.
There you go.
But everything leading up to that, yeah, it's fairly brutal in those books.
Yeah.
They are mean, man, but life was meaner back then, too.
So I actually just discovered something. As it turns out, I've seen an adaption of Call of the Wild, actually, by the fucking Peanuts. one of the weirdest tapes I had of Charlie Brown that I liked. Yeah, What a Nightmare, Charlie Brown. That was it. And as a kid, it baffled me because I was like, what the fuck? But it was still really cool. And now I look at this and I'm like, oh my God.
Well, if I remember this. They're
literally like, it's a straight up near adaption of it.
I believe Lucy dies in the snow.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That's right. Linus is forced to eat her in order to survive.
Right. No, Snoopy. Snoopy's gnawing on a leg bump.
Oh man.
Now he gets back. So now he's out of the Yukon Territory. London returns to California, intent to escape manual labor. Does not want to go back to this. He's now seen the brutal conditions of the Yukon, but he also doesn't want to go back to the fucking cannery. So he has an interesting line here. He decides he's going to sell his brain in a sort of fuck you move to the rich people that he resented. London went through some difficulty getting published until he finally received $40 for one of his published short stories, which, by the way, if you adjust for inflation, Mr. J, $1,100. All right. That's not bad. That's still more money than I've ever made for a single gig in comedy. I'll give him that. But due to the boom in printed fiction and the popularity of short stories, which you talked about earlier, man, that's what London was best at. London's able to make in 2018 dollars, you adjust for inflation here, between all the publications in the year 1900, he's able to make $75,000 off of his writings, okay?
Wait, for altogether, from everything?
For everything. Because you saw his list of work, man. I mean, he's spitting out. He'll write a journal. He'll write an article for a newspaper. He'll do this. He'll do that. He's got short stories. He's got longer novels. He's got poems. A little bit of everything.
Now, was this a time where, like, are his daughters still – well, his descendants, are they still getting stuff, or is his stuff long in the public domain?
He's pretty much – he's largely in the public domain too, because, I mean, he is an American legend. And then – but there's still got to be some sort of a profit being made off of him, I would imagine. Now, 1903, London wrote what would become his most popular work, The Call of the Wild. He sold it to a famous paper, the Saturday Evening Post, for $750. All right.
Not a bad chunk of change back then.
No, it was not. Now, the book rights are also given to Macmillan Publishing, pretty famous publishing firm still around today, who ensure that the book is a guaranteed success. London sells his brains, and he's not really going to be going back to oyster pirating anytime soon.
Better than 10 cents an hour at the cannery.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he made it at this point. London had affection, but not love, for his first wife. She largely feels the same way, kind of a marriage by friendship, if you will. The two of them have this long history together, and they're comfortable enough to be married but without any sort of romance. Her name is Bessie that he decides to get married to. And Bessie was a rather conservative woman, not quite ready for the wild lifestyle that accompanies being married to Jack London. And as we covered in the early part of this episode, when you're Eskimo cousins with Houdini, that's a small circle to be in, you know what I mean? But Bessie was kind of a purity-driven kind of a person here, and they did have two daughters, Joan and Becky. London kept the family in a very comfortable house in Piedmont, where he would continue to write and thrive as a writer. But Bessie and London began having marital issues due to Bessie's problem with the fact that London loved alcohol and prostitutes. All right? Not really stuff you can come back from in a marriage, all right, unless you're the lead singer of Kiss. But Bessie feared London might give her a venereal disease, because when he would come back from these trips, Kahuna, she would not want to be around him. They wouldn't even like share a marital bed or anything like that. So she didn't want to have sex with him when he came back from these voyages he was on, because she was positive that he was banging prostitutes overseas.
Well, I think that also might be that they weren't having any kind of relations other than he and Shane involved for the birth of their two kids. and that was pretty much it.
But, yeah, you guarantee they did it twice, but not much after that. Right. So the marriage
children
would end,
more like fuck trophies.
Well, their marriage ends, unfortunately, in 1904 with a formal divorce, and London moves out, but he still has nothing but fondness for her. All right, he admires
still
taking
care of the kids, too.
Takes care of the kids, takes care of her. He's not a bad guy. It just wasn't a marriage where they were in love with each other. But there's a little contention there at times.
A little more than a little.
I think it's better than most, because there's a lot of people that just be like, all right, I'm moving out. Because you could – keep in mind, you could just move to a different state and never provide for those kids again. But much like in his father's letter, London decides a change of scenery is necessary for himself. And he goes ahead. He takes a position – this is my favorite part of his life – takes a position as a war correspondent for the San Francisco Examiner, a paper owned by media magnate – William Randolph Hearst. Have you ever heard of him, Kahuna? Do you know any movies that are made loosely about his life that are considered the greatest, you know, movie of all time?
I'm just going to keep my mouth shut.
I hear you.
Wow. Yeah. All right.
Citizen Kane, you were right. You started saying and then you stopped. Citizen Kane is based off the life of William Randolph Hearst. A little side note here that I think people will find interesting. In the movie Rosebud, that's the whole mystery behind the movie, so I won't ruin what Rosebud means in the movie. But Orson Welles is such a he's such an annoying prick. I mean, with how smart and genius he was, he writes this movie. He finds out that William Randolph Hearst refers to his girlfriend's pussy as Rosebud. That perhaps I'll see Rosebud later on today. So he goes ahead and he uses that as the nickname for it. So then Orson Welles finds this out and writes it into the movie loosely based about the guy's life, where they change just enough details that William Randolph Hearst doesn't get any credit for the movie. So, then just to add another fuck you.
The censors.
Yeah. And then another fuck you, Orson Welles plays him. So.
Yeah. Right.
But during
but Orson, I mean William Randolph Hearst too made his life's mission to not only own a couple of newspapers, but he wanted to be, you know, across the U.S. and across the globe, that he wanted to be the controlling interest in all media.
his great quote. You remember his quote about for I believe it was the Spanish-American War. You provide the pictures, I'll provide the war.
Right.
So
provide the story too.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I just found the most roundabout Jersey connection.
Oh, God bless you.
So his boss was William Hurst. The movie was Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane, Orson Welles. Orson Welles, War of the Worlds, New Jersey.
Ah, there you go. No shit. Not bad. You had to shoehorn that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, that one was, oh my God. I had like a map.
That was a couple of steps.
Yeah, that was a few steps. I'm forcing it on that one. I don't care.
I'm cool with it, brother.
I love finding the Jersey connections.
Well, now London's time, he joins up. He takes this war correspondence thing. The big to-do in the world this time is the Russo-Japanese War. Now, we don't have a Jersey tie in here, but we do have a tie into another theme of the show in a second. London is traveling with the Japanese Imperial Army. And because he's our boy Jack London, who likes to drink and doesn't like to follow orders and kind of, you know, does his own thing, he's arrested on four separate occasions for disobeying orders and getting too close to the fighting lines. His final arrest was for attacking one of his Japanese assistants. London was often called racist, like we talked about earlier, Jay. For writing about what he called the Yellow Peril, which was his name for the large Asian migrations to the United States. However, London's writings of the Japanese culture, it's very clear that he admired a lot of parts of their society. And Japanese people are actually very fond of Jack London's portrayal of them because Japan wasn't really – they were a world power, but they weren't on the world stage as a power, if you will, at this time. So they're very interesting here, and they are fond of how London portrayed them. Now, that's despite the four arrests. The man who arranged the release of London when he was finally imprisoned that one last time, okay, for assaulting his own assistants, is the guy who winds up having to organize his release. He's also the guy who wins the Nobel Peace Prize for ending the Russo-Japanese War by inviting the two leaders to come in and sign the Treaty of Portsmouth. Want to guess who that is, Kahuna? Who's the one guy we tell you not to fuck with on this podcast?
No fucking way. No fucking way.
Yes, Jack
way.
London's in prison. All right. Well, guess who's going to get him out? Teddy motherfucking Roosevelt. All right. Who's going to end the Russo-Japanese War? Teddy motherfucking Roosevelt. So London then returns to the United States, and we're getting towards the end of his it's a very short life for our friend Jack London. And he returns to the United States and is given an honorary membership to what we were
anchor anyone else on that list. Like, this dude has had such ups and downs that, like, I can understand him being the actual foundation of the scale, if that makes any fucking sense whatsoever. If not, just consider it the mad ramblings of Big Kahuna on the Sunday night.
Yeah, Kahuna's having one of his mad drunks right now.
Oh, but, man.
Jay, real quick, where can people find you on social media? We do have listeners for the show.
Well, we're going to see how this works. I currently have 15 followers on Twitter at JAugustHC. KP is one of them, so
consider
if you want to find
16.
Consider 16. And we're going to see how I can go up from 15 to maybe 16 now to as many as 20.
Wow.
Because I'd like to have enough following that later on, if I do get famous, my Twitter feed can follow me and ruin me.
Getting famous is an interesting problem to have. That's one of those things here. Really, just follow him because when Jay talks about getting famous, you don't know if he's talking about success as a writer, success as a stand-up comedian, or a manifesto after he inevitably shoots up a government building. So there's no way to tell. LP, where can people find you?
Find me?
Oh, yeah, South Beach in about 2 weeks.
Probably out in the garage working on something.
Oh, that part's going to suck, man. Hit me, brother.
You mind if I give you one final insult for our boy Jack London here?
Absolutely.
He died on March 22nd, November 22nd. It's the same day that C.S. Lewis and Aldous Huxley died in 1963. That stands out in everybody's mind because November 22nd, 1963 is when JFK
absolutely
was killed.
Oh, man.
So now the day of his death is now three other prolific writers and nobody is going to notice it.
Oh, that's brilliant. You share your same death day.
Share the same death day and it's completely overshadowed.
Sorry, Jack. Should have waited one more day to kill yourself. You were in control on this one.
Yeah, no holiday for you.
Brutal, man.
Out with that morphine for one more day.
That's half the battle there, man. But that's why I did say there is a little bit of a Kurt Cobain type thing with him where he's got this gorgeous place out in California and you know, winds up possibly killing his own self because he just couldn't deal with the pain anymore, man.
Yeah, but you know what? He had so many things wrong with him, tropical diseases and the scurvy, the kidney failure, the alcoholism and everything else. And morphine was probably the only thing that was going to be able to relieve, to give him any kind of relief from the pain. So, you know, I think it's very questionable as to whether he just offed himself or whether he was just looking to seek some relief from the pain that he was going through. So, but that's my take.
No, I agree with you on that one, man. But what a fascinating life the guy led here. And again, we put a positive spin on it with some of the Disney movies and everything, but this guy wrote some heavy shit. So anything else before we roll out here, fellas?
He predicted fascism.
Really?
He predicted the rise of fascism. His early short story, The Iron Eel, predicted the rise of Hitler 20 years before it happened.
No shit.
This is interesting. I'm reading about some of his animal activism. It's literally the smallest thing on his Wikipedia page, but it's actually kind of cool. He was one of the first people to call out circus animals, like in their abuse and all that type of stuff. And I think that that's actually kind of cool.
The elephant wants to smoke the cigarette, Kahuna. Don't you understand? What don't you understand?
He enjoys.
But no, he was a fascinating guy here on that one. We got to move in because our next guest is coming. We're going to try to bang out another episode here before LP goes back to South Beach and abandons me. But guys, I want to say thank you again. If you like the show, please do us a favor. Leave us a review on iTunes. I'm not asking any money from you yet. Okay, we're going to have to eventually because I lose money every time we're here. But that being said, Kahuna's going to have to edit out the part where I dropped a couple of F-bombs unnecessarily around the 28-minute mark. So if you guys hear a jump in the action, it's because I had one of my freak-out moments. And we're going to wrap this show up here because I have to pee again because this nitro coffee flies through you. But that being said, guys, my name was KP Burke. I want to say thank you to all my guests. I want to say thank you to my friend Jay August coming on, my old man for making me love history, Kahuna for the ones and twos, Mike and Ming for giving us a studio to do the show in here. And ladies and gentlemen, that was Jack London, American Loser.
American loser the day I was born. An American loser the day I was born. An American loser the day I was born.